And we're back here with Mike Boych and Bud Colligan and Sunil Paul. This is Pod Summit. We're about to start our second segment with Sunil, talking about angel investing and also about his activity in India and China and what's happening in some of these new markets. So Sunil, we had a good talk on our first segment. I want to dig down a little bit more into angel investing now. In the first segment, we talked about some of your angel investments in the clean tech area. But I'm also interested in you as an angel investor and the network of angels that you've developed. You seem to work with some of the same people like Mark Pincus and Reid Hoffman as the CEO of LinkedIn. Tell me about how you got into angel investing and how you view it as a disciplined investment practice. or lack of disciplined investment practice.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, the way that I got started in angel investing is back in like 1997. So I made some money on Freeloader. And there's just so much. I mean, this is 1997, right? Yeah. I mean, things are going nuts. People are, well, like Freeloader, selling their companies 6 months after they start them, except, you know, it's no longer a big deal. And when we did that, especially in D.C., it was, you know, all over the papers, and it was such a big deal. And this was happening left and right. And, you know, you'd invest in a company at some valuation, and they'd raise another round 6 months later at twice or three times the amount, and it was just nuts. And someone would come and talk to you and say, oh, well, we might get acquired. And you talk to them next week, and they've been acquired. So it was just, it was a crazy time. And so it sort of fed a lack of discipline. And I'd meet with companies, and I invested as an angel investor over a lunch. I would meet with someone and say, yeah, that sounds great, and I'd put money in. And of course, you know, hardly any of those turned into good investments. Actually, it turns out that several of them turned into good investments, so I fortunately made money on it. But the crash taught me a lot of lessons, because so many of them ended up being stupid investments. And I thought, well, I was also doing it while I was running another company, so frankly, I didn't have time to go look at these things. When I came back to it as a clean tech investor, I said, well, if you're going to do this, do it with the intention of making money. Do it with the intention of having it as a profession, not as sort of a little thing that you do as a hobby because you think it's fun, which is basically what I did before. So, I mean, my practice now for investment is drastically different. I mean, I go through a full due diligence process. I go and interview third-party technologists to validate the technology. I do reference checks on the entrepreneurs. Usually there's not a lot of legal due diligence to do because, you know, first money in, there's nothing really there. But, yeah, I mean, I do a fair amount of work to do an investment. And as a result, it's hard to, it doesn't really make sense to do a small investment. I mean, whereas previously, if someone wanted an investment, I thought it was an interesting idea, I might, I don't know, put in $10,000 or $20,000. But it just doesn't make any sense to put that kind of money in if you're going to go do all that work. Mm-hmm. So now, typically, I try to put in, you know, sort of a starting amount of $50,000 to $100,000 and look to put either hundreds of thousands, as much as a million to work in a particular company over the course of its lifetime.
So you're behaving more like a professional venture capitalist, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Except you don't have the only fiduciary responsibility you have is to yourself.
That's the part I like about it.
Which gives you a bit more latitude. So what's the typical time frame that it would take you to evaluate an investment and execute on it? Or similarly, how many investments would you look to do over the course of a year?
Well, it usually takes me about start to finish. I've only made three clean tech investments, and that's not for lack of trying. It's I've had a tough time finding good companies, which we can come back to that. But I think for each one of those, it took me about 2 months start to finish. Mm-hmm. So it's a considerable effort. I've had a hard time. You know, when I began that process, I thought I would invest in 2 to 3 companies a year, with the intention of, over the course of 3 or 4 years, building a portfolio of about a dozen companies, which, you know, also just thinking harder about the whole problem, I realized that you need an investment in multiple companies to really build out sort of a risk-balanced portfolio. And I've had a hard time finding good companies. I mean, there are not that many, especially 4 years ago and 3 years ago, there weren't that many good investments, I think, in the clean tech world. And for good investments, I mean, I'm looking for companies that can turn into massive companies and not companies, and, you know, that means companies that can go public and continue to grow beyond that. And part of what I see in the clean tech world is a lot of people are willing to make investments in companies where they just expect them to be sold, or, and, you know, frankly, that's been until SunPower, the experience for clean tech has been either the company that's hyped to death and not hyped to death, hyped to a public offering and then dies a slow death afterwards. Ballard probably being the best example there. Ballard is a big fuel cell company that had huge hype, had a multi-billion-dollar market cap at one point, and has fallen terribly from there. Or companies that sort of struggle along and then get bought for, you know, reasonable multiples, but not sort of the home run
tens
returns.
Of millions, not hundreds of millions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so SunPower, I think, is a significant development because, you know, it's profitable, it's growing rapidly, and it's got, you know, a great market cap that many people think is unsustainable, but nevertheless, it's at least opened people's eyes to the fact that you can build a profitable company in this space, take it public, have all those things that you expect in a venture kind of company to happen.
Why do you think it's been hard to invest in this area? What are the, other than market cap and exits, what are the fundamentals that have made it difficult for you to pull the trigger on more clean tech investments?
I think for, it was everything. It was not great. Often the management teams weren't that good. I think there was a lot of distraction by ideas that I just, for example, this whole hydrogen economy thing got a lot of entrepreneurs excited, got some investors excited, but I just didn't believe in it. And so that was sort of an entire category of companies that when someone came to me and said, I've got a hydrogen economy coming, I'm like, okay, good. Go talk to someone else. So I think that's part of it. It was just the ideas weren't ripe. The management teams often weren't ripe. And also, I think another factor that makes it hard as a first-stage investor is your biggest risk is that the company's going to need more money. It almost always needs more money. And so your biggest risk is that the company can't pull together all the things it needs to raise that first round of money. Because some of these companies, if they raise that first round, they can at least, they have a shot at getting to cash flow even. You know, usually with a combination of some government grants or something like that. But, you know, on the less than $1 million that they're going to raise in an angel round or sort of that seed round, they can't get there. And so the biggest risk is that you're not going to get to that next big step. And so when, in those early days, when there wasn't that same kind of interest in the venture community, it made it just a lot more risky. So it made me a lot more risky about and a lot more cautious about putting money in. But that environment has changed a lot as well.
Yeah, but people are often talk about recreating Silicon Valley in other geographies or in other industries. And if we look at what exists here, entrepreneurs who have the drive and have ideas and experience. It's investors who understand what those entrepreneurs are trying to do and are able to both fund the companies and help the entrepreneurs. And then customers who understand that are willing to deal with startups, et cetera. So If you think about those components in the energy industry, what's the status? How many are there enough investors who really understand the business and can add value to the entrepreneur's efforts?
Yeah, every it seems like there's been an explosion of VC interest because everyone that was doing infrastructure or enterprise software is now doing clean tech. They've all repositioned themselves as clean tech investors.
Yeah.
A couple of funds, which we won't name here, have even announced, clean tech initiatives and so forth. So I'm just curious what your take on that is per Mike's
questions. Well, I have to say, I do think there's a bit of a phenomena of, in addition to sort of the attraction and realization that there's opportunity based on the macro fundamental sort of what I painted earlier in the previous segment, why I think there's an opportunity in this space, and evidence of that in things like SunPower, there's also the fear factor, which is that these other segments aren't doing so well. It's no mistake that I got very interested in this in 2002. The tech sector was on its knees, and the idea of investing in an internet company was not very appealing back then. And so, things happened to come together for me at that time. So, I think you're right. There is a little bit of, these other sectors, telecom doesn't look so hot, and enterprise software isn't looking so good anymore, so what else can we do? Oh, well, there's this other area that looks promising. One very different thing in the clean tech world, there are lots of very different things. I think one big one is that you're actually building something. Another significant difference is that the customer base is so different in each one of these things. So I think that some of the more interesting customer bases, like you say, one of the things that has made IT, the sort of venture world and IT world work, and the biotech world work, is that there are existing pathways and customers that are willing to take a risk on new ideas.
Yeah.
And that's a tough challenge in the clean tech world. I think solar, a lot of the distributed power ideas of solar and fuel cells are a lot better suited to that because you have smaller installations, there are constantly new ones coming up, and so you have opportunities to try new things. So it is definitely a different experience than the existing sort of software and biotech world.
Sort of concluding this part on angel investing, when you think about how you've added value or not added value in the companies that you've been involved in, you've also been around lots of other angels. Usually when you go into these deals, there's three or four others with you. You had angels in your own companies. What have they done to add value, and where do you attempt to add value when you go into a company before any professional money?
Yeah. Generally, angels are all over the map from just providing money, which in some cases, that's a good scenario because I know of some companies where the angels basically consist of people who call up and are constantly asking questions and never adding any value. But, at least in the companies I've worked with directly, the sort of worst case scenario is they just give you money. But often there are angels that can provide advice on the business direction itself, help recruit talent into the company, and of course providing introductions to investors. But I think the area, and actually one other thing is just by having certain angels involved in certain companies sort of gives it a certain amount of credibility so that other either talent or partners or investors or whoever are more attracted to that company. So those are all sort of the soft ways that angels can help. I think where I've helped a lot with really with all those companies. The one I didn't mention is Urja Protonics, which is still in stealth mode, but they're a fuel cell company, just raised a round. Is helping to really think through the business model and think through sort of what the market opportunity is, how you go about attacking that market opportunity, how you might change the product in small ways to address those market opportunities, and then you know, it really is true that venture investors are expecting a certain format of a pitch. And I think a lot of companies get a little too wrapped up in that, but there's also a fair number of companies that just don't understand that sort of recipe of how you go about talking to venture investors. And even the ones that do, sometimes they just, I don't know, for whatever reason, they're not that good at it. And so I feel like I've helped a lot in those realms as well.
Great. Maybe we should switch gears and talk a little bit about India.
Sure.
You're of Indian descent. You have some. Tell us about your interest in the country and how those are playing out.
Yeah, well, first of all, I was born in India. I was born in Punjab, which is the northwest province near the border with Pakistan. I came to the U.S. when I was very young, 4 years old, to Stillwater, Oklahoma, in 1967. So I've been here a long time. And I had never been back to India until right before I joined AOL. I went back for a brief visit in, this was 1990, January of 94. So India had just opened up its economy. And it was, I mean, by just meaning there was very little evidence that the economy had opened up, but technically they had. In 91, they started their economic reforms. And I visited my, it was a sort of a trip to visit relatives with very, very small little sightseeing along the way. And I have to tell you, it was not a good experience for me. I mean, I loved connecting with my relatives who I hadn't, in some cases, never seen. But the experience of being in India, the experience of traveling in India, the levels of air pollution, and the sort of poverty that was everywhere was overwhelming for me. It was a hard experience, and hard enough and sort of traumatic enough for me that I didn't want to go back. And I didn't go back for another 10 years. But in 2004, I went back. My sister, who goes there a lot, was there and said, why don't you come over and visit? I'm going to be in Bangalore, and you know, there's all this stuff going on. Why don't you come and talk to people about what's going on in the tech world? So I went. I met with people there. And then we went to Goa, which is a great little beach area. So that was a good trip, and I can tell you more about sort of the experience in Bangalore. But what I sort of was reflecting on, I just got back from India a couple of weeks ago, and this was the second time I'd been back to go visit family since that trip in 1994. And I was really struck by just the transformation of the country. I mean, in 12 years since I had been back, you know, the air in Delhi is breathable. The transportation systems work better. There are domestic airliners that are better than ones in the U.S. There is a reliable internet service and wireless service. There, people have cell phones everywhere. The prosperity of people is evident, even though there's still a lot of poverty and continues to be a big challenge for the country. But it is just remarkable what has happened to that country, in particular near the cities. I mean, I visited family in Punjab as well, and there the changes are not as obvious. But it is a country that's been transformed, and it's real evidence of sort of the power of opening up markets and the real power of disengaging the government from sectors of the economy where they don't belong.
Are there particular, in both Bangalore and your recent trip, are there particular areas that you were particularly excited about in terms of new business opportunities?
Well, I continue to be excited about, I think there's just sort of a huge number of opportunities in India and China. And it's all over the map. Everything from information technology and biotech, sort of the traditional areas that venture investors are interested in, to new areas like sort of business outsourcing and related things to that. And I think in the clean tech world, there's tremendous opportunity as well. Certainly in being able to leverage India and China for their sort of low-cost capabilities. but also ultimately being able to leverage the talent and creativity there. I mean, they're, both those cultures have, and I don't think it's just about the cultures of India and China. I think there's sort of a universal human phenomena of wanting to unleash your creativity and entrepreneurship. It's just that, you know, in many cases you're tied up and not able to do it. But both India and China are opening up in that regard, and that power of entrepreneurship is happening. And so I think ultimately the big opportunity is to enable entrepreneurs in India and China to go out and create companies that first go out and conquer markets where they are, because those are markets that they understand, and they're in much, much better position to go build products for their own markets, rather than having someone come in and try to design those products. But once they've created those markets, once they've created those products, a lot of those companies can be world-beating companies. You know, the cost of a cell phone call in India is incredibly small, and the service quality of the domestic carriers, airline carriers, in India is incredibly high, and the cost is very, very modest. And so those kinds of services, once they start going outside of India, are going to make a big impact. I think it'll be a similar phenomenon to what happened with sort of Japanese quality. I mean, you had sort of a core competence of Japan of just delivering on very high quality of manufacturing, and that ended up being a sort of a world-beating capability. And to a lesser extent, the same kind of thing happened in Korea and Taiwan. So I think we're going to see the same kind of things out of India and China.
And do you foresee a component of your angel investing activity then that will
possibly? It's still very early. I mean, I certainly have a lot of ideas. I've been going around talking to people about my 11 ideas, of which only about 4 of them are company ideas. I've got a lot of nonprofit ideas as well. But a lot of those have India-China components. So, yeah, there'll probably be something going on in that world for me.
I think it's ironic that you're referring to sort of the spirit of entrepreneurial activity in India and China, because, you know, that's what really got things started here to such a great extent, certainly in Silicon Valley, but I think in the United States overall. Yeah. And the power of serving those consumers who need to be served from a very low cost base and are starting out with a very high service level is just a very powerful concept. And you combine that with a natural entrepreneurial activity, which I agree with you, doesn't necessarily need to be ascribed to the nationalities of China or India, but just the overall human desire to express your creativity and to do something to change the world is going to be very powerful. And we've seen that spirit alive here, and I think we're seeing it grow and be nurtured in other areas of the world now. So I want to really thank
you. Amen, brother.
I want to thank you for joining Mike and myself today. It's been fascinating to talk about everything from angel investing to building companies to doing it around the world and to do it in new areas like clean tech. So I appreciate your time, and I'm sure our listeners will really enjoy listening to what you have to say.
Well, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Sunil.